Russians in Kamchatka, a wild and resource-rich region of eastern Russia, frequently talk about worsening environmental conditions. But American researcher Jessica Graybill says few, if any, of the Russians living there blame climate change.
So in other words, even in the face of a changed resource base that is potentially worse than before, local and because of climate changes and other changes, local and indigenous peoples largely express that we will be resilient and overcome these problems. Okay, either in personal actions, by technological improvement, or if the government suddenly becomes proactive in resource conservation. And that would be a new thing in the Russian case.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, Colgate University Professor of Geography Jessica Graybill discusses the discourse of climate change in Russia. That's coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. As understanding of the reality of global climate change has increased in recent decades, discourse about what it means, what the implications are for local regions and individual countries and communities, and importantly, what exactly to do about it, remains an ongoing process of discourse and policymaking. We are all pretty familiar with the discourse of climate change here in the United States and how it has spurred either urgent calls for policy actions or resistance to those calls and even denial of the science altogether. American climate discourse has also created confusion or just apathy from parts of the population here. But what has been the discourse around climate change in other countries? Well, Jessica Graybill is professor of geography at Colgate University, and she studies the climate change discourse in Russia by Russian citizens across that massive country. And today we're going to be airing her recent talk at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Jessica Graybill is director of the Russia and Eurasian Studies program there, and she researches urban and socio-environmental transformations on communities and resource extraction communities in and around Russia. And just a note to listeners, during her talk, she occasionally refers to some slides, and you can find a link to the video version of her talk with those slides on our website. Her talk was recorded last week, Monday, February 6th.
Knowledge of the reality of global climate change has increased dramatically over the past several decades globally, as local, regional, and global climate and weather changes are increasingly witnessed, discussed among communities anywhere, and scientifically studied and confirmed. So today I'm really excited to talk to you about the results of one of my research studies, as well as about some of the conversations I've had with people across Russia in various settings and contexts about climate change, both, right? Same things sometimes and sometimes different things. Some of these conversations are not necessarily directly related to my research, but I find them helpful for understanding the results. I include both of these formal, scientific, and informal over tea conversations here today because the goal of talking about Siberia and Asia in greater context. That context for me is simultaneously geographic, historical, and cultural. Okay, so I'm going to show you, geographer, I have to show you a map. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the climate narratives that I've heard across all these places. But one of the things I'm going to focus on the research I've done, which is over here in the Far East. Okay, and then much more informal conversations for thinking about climate and climate change, weather, over here in more European and Arctic parts of Russia. Let's see. And so when I point to the Far East to think about this, I'm going to tell you a story today mostly about Kamchatka. But I'm going to include little snippets from Sakhalin Island and from Vladivostok. And the reason for that is Russia is divided into seven federal regions right now. And science is structured around these regions. So Vladivostok is really a hub for scientific information that goes out to Sakhalin Island and that goes out to Kamchatka as well. So even though I'll tell you a story about Kamchatka, they're really all related. Okay, so when I say I've heard something on Kamchatka, often I'm hearing the same things in those other places as well. Let's see. Okay, so here we go. Focus on Kamchatka. Here it is, way up here on the very far eastern and somewhat northern edge of Russia. If we were to follow the Aleutian Islands over, that's exactly what runs straight into Kamchatka from Alaska if we were to follow those over. Where I was and how I studied this was in two very small communities in the middle of Kamchatka, Esso and Anafgai, and also in the capital city on this peninsula, Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky. And so Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky is about 200,000 people, 250,000 people most of the time, not all the time, but that's a good estimate for how many people might live there. And then you can see from the map here that the populations in Esso and Anafgai are quite a lot smaller. So both, well, one actually a magnitude of larger than the other, Esso coming in at about 2,600 people, and Anafgai 800. And there are reasons for this. One of them, particularly Anafgai, is a settlement of indigenous peoples who are mostly Ivyank, but some Itilmien. And in Esso, we have a mix of those indigenous peoples as well as, for lack of a better term, post-Soviet peoples from all over the former Soviet Union that have stayed in this region. That have stayed in this region since the collapse of the Soviet Union after 1991. They consider it home. So that's a little bit of sort of where I was for studying these things. But I think another where is really thinking about how Kamchatka is thought about by people in Russia, certainly, and perhaps us as a more global community. So framing the results of talking to people about climate change, the perceptions of change on the landscape, is really important for understanding how they might think about things and how to think about the role, the place of humans in such transformation. So bear with me, little pun here. Right, bear with me while I provide a couple of examples on this slide and on the next. So Kamchatka has long been perceived as a peninsula of wilder than wild nature, where humans and human impacts on nature are dwarfed. Tales of its natural wonders, the large brown bears, rivers teeming with infinite numbers of salmon, geysers, volcanoes, and geothermal springs have been told and become mythical within European Russia for at least the last 200 years. Since the earliest expeditions of the Russian Geographical Society, Kamchatka has been a romanticized destination for Tsarist, Russian, Soviet, and now post-Soviet field researchers. Today, in the post-Soviet era, it's also a destination for extreme tourism, only for the toughest and bravest who are ready to heli-ski or hunt bear in the company of volcanoes, earthquakes, and in summer, six-foot-high nettles and scrub oak that must There's not an option here. Must be macheted down to reach destinations like the Valley of the Geysers or virtually untouched salmon spawning grounds. And that'll become important in my tale a little bit later. This face of Kamchatka suggests a raw, wild nature that must be preserved at all costs for the greater human and ecological good. Local guides, of course, lead the way for visitors through this fairy tale wilderness. There's another face of Kamchatka that I became very familiar with when I lived in this area in 2009-2010. This face is has very different stories attached to it that are not related to the same romantic passion for this wilderness area and are instead related to subsistence or semi-subsistence level existence of its populations. So prior to the settlement of Soviet citizens across Kamchatka by the mid-20th century, indigenous peoples had developed multiple yet often interrelated indigenous cultures and histories that were largely accepting and inclusive of multiple hunter-gatherer, fishing, and caribou herding cultures in the pre-Soviet era. They largely cooperated with each other to trade, share resources, and hunt, gather, or fish, living nomadically or semi-nomadically, either moving through these mountainous landscapes, moving out of them when it got super snowy and hard to navigate, and moving to coastal areas where fish and other marine animals were abundant. But in the Soviet era, near destruction and then repression of indigenous cultures and peoples denied them their basic rights to these activities, which had been life-sustaining forces for centuries in this region. Instead, indigenous peoples, often referred to here as the children of nature by the paternalistic empire, were herded into compact settlements resembling urban settings, their caribou regimented, and their familial ties broken through institutions like boarding schools. We certainly have some of this history in this nation as well. But here, in this nearly completely successful attempt to destroy cultural ties to homelands and close-knit families to create Homo Sovieticus, the new Soviet citizen, the Soviet Union also destroyed a rich knowledge base of local resources, places, and traditions, many of which honored ecological laws. On Soviet and now post-Soviet Kamchatka, then, resource over-harvest, so overtaking all sorts of different things from nature, has become rampant as indigenous peoples and settlers from around the Soviet Union have attempted to either, one, subsist to survive, or two, make a very fast dollar, and it is indeed dollars, off of the abundant resources before the ruble is devalued again or before the resources disappear. So over-harvest, largely of seafood and salmon, is a practice that gained speed towards the end of the Soviet period due to mismanagement of nature and corruption within the Soviet system and a lack of economic controls that fined people or industry for inefficient use of resources. So over-harvest is now the modus operandi among commercial and individual actors alike. Take, especially of salmon, has flown off the charts, okay, threatening not only one of the last remaining strongholds of wild salmon worldwide, but also threatening the entire ecosystem, including the keystone species within it, those bears, and of course us humans, both of whom depend on salmon for survival. So in the words of one indigenous person, salmon gives us everything, and without it, we will all die. So these pictures up here are showing the trajectory of going from subsistence living, taking 20 salmon, right, and scooping the caviar. That's all the red row in here is salmon caviar, scooping it out, preserving both pieces for the future, to over-harvest, right, of those fish. So going from 20 fish to hundreds, thousands of fish at a time, and taking just the row out and leaving the salmon behind, because the row is the valuable commodity. So in 2010, a kilogram of salmon sold for a dollar. Right? Wild salmon, wild Pacific salmon sold for a dollar. A kilogram of the roe sold for upwards of $10, $15. So again, it's a magnitude of order greater in terms of its value, and it's sold in both legal, illegal, and quasi-legal forums today. Okay, so this paints sort of a picture of what's going on the ground right now. So right now, Kamchatka is a fish economy. It's a place for one of the last strongholds of wild salmon in the world, wild Pacific salmon. But it's also a fish economy for the present and foreseeable future. And that's at all levels, industrial, small business, and family subsistence. To put it this way, if Russia's oil and gas industry in this region makes up 5% of the total, Kamchatka's fisheries comprise 40% of the national fisheries industry. So right now, fish here is king, and it's more vital to the economy than hydrocarbons in the Sea of Okhotsk on the West Kamchatka Shelf, which is, if we put it in greater context, right over here, I blew it up in a sort of a cartoony way on the picture you were just looking at, but if we put it in greater context to where other oil and gas operations are occurring now on Sakhalin Island, we can see that possibly this is the next place, the next future for where oil and gas will be harvested. And of course, exploited. And what you can see is it's exactly the same places where fish habitat is the largest and the most important to this region. So you're wondering, okay, I thought this would talk about climate change. Why is she telling me about fish and over-harvest of fish? So I'm telling you this in preparation to get you thinking about extractive industries and how people are thinking about both subsistence-style resources and extractive resources with this overarching narrative globally of climate change. So how are people putting all of these different pieces together? Okay, so one more slide on resource spaces and one more little bit to think about that, and then I'll definitely move to the climate change aspect. So what's happening here is what geographers might call a multi-harvest resource space. So you have people using fish for their own use, right, and then industrial levels upwards to commercial levels, very large commercial extraction. But we also have oil and gas looming on the horizon as the future for this region, especially if climate change continues. Okay? Because, and why is that? Because salmon are very temperature-dependent species. Right? So if the temperature of the waters that they move through changes, they may not come back. right? They may choose to go eventually to another river somewhere else, but not to where they've gone before. So right now, just going back to this last slide, where we see all the fish that are very important through this region, if climate change continues and sea temperatures change, then that's going to change for this region. And that means potentially that oil and gas becomes more important than the current fish harvest. So, excuse me, gasification of this island by Gazprom has occurred. And gasification means that gas has been brought to all of the villages and all the homes through this region. And that's very recent. That's a very recent post-Soviet thing that's happened, and people are proud of that. But the larger scale hydrocarbon developments that are coming, that look more like this across tundra and taiga areas, and that take out large swaths of the forests and then also of tundra as well, and that reach out to the coasts, are things that people are scared of, right? Often because they go across these salmon-bearing streams. And it's on hold right now. Okay, and this is partially trying to understand Russian oil and gas industry right now as well. Lots of these big projects are on hold for lots of different reasons. One of them is that they're extremely expensive to work in the north, and so that's the Arctic and the subarctic. It's very expensive to run these projects. It's hard places to get in and out of. It's remote. You have to pay workers a lot to work here. And often those workers are workers that are not Soviet, or not Soviet, not post-Soviet citizens. They are citizens that are, they are people that are coming to work these places from Canada, from the US, from Scotland, from Australia. So in other words, places where people expect high wages, right? And they're coming in a totally different capacity than they have before. So exploratory drilling began on this West Kamchatka shelf that I showed you just a little bit ago, which in 2011. And that's right now home to Kamchatka's richest fishing regions. But if these hydrocarbon reserves become more valuable in the future, the relatively well-managed operations of oil and gas extraction from Sakhalin Island, which I'll talk to you about in just a minute, will provide a gateway for exporting unprocessed oil and gas out of this region via Sakhalin's liquefied natural gas terminal and by tankers to Asian and US markets. Okay, so my research a year ago or so in Vladivostok, which involved oil and gas specialists, confirms that Russia is fully planning to move ahead with these projects in the future. Right now, it's just a question of time in terms of understanding when those will start. Right now, fish is king, but oil and gas is coming. Okay, also of concern to local and indigenous peoples throughout this region is mineral extraction. So precious metals and minerals, gold, platinum, nickel, cobalt, are all abundant on Kamchatka. And so on land placer mining operations, such as the one you see here, began certainly not in this capacity during the Gulag era, wasn't quite this organized then, and after a brief hiatus in the 1990s, continues today in these fly-in, fly-out, or FIFO operations that are largely operated by transnational corporations. So we're seeing massive change in this region in terms of the kinds of resources that are taken, right, and used in place, but also moved to other places for continued use. Okay. So this is sort of the socioeconomic culture, not even cultural, but just socioeconomic background of what's going on in a lot of Far Eastern Russia right now, coastal regions. Talking about biophysical change, I think is really, really important for thinking about this. And often we geographers immediately go to thinking about climate change. Well, biophysical change must today mean climate change, right? We've had about 5, 6, 7, maybe even 10 years of almost pure focus just on that in terms of thinking about biophysical change. But this is also, it's kind of a little bit hard to see, but that's all right. This is also fully an image of biophysical change of the region. So this picture is showing us salmon streams are running across the slide, if you will, east to west here, right, if you will. Think about up and down, right, left to right. Salmon streams are running across here, and you can see one forking right here across this slide, right? So we've got salmon streams here. Now all of these striations are tracks of vehicles driven by poachers. So people who are going out and looking for salmon roe. Not the salmon again, but just to take the roe out of those salmon for sale on the market. Legal and illegal. So This is not climate change, right? But this is definitely biophysical change with a big impact on the environment. And so here's a shot here of thinking about what these kinds of vehicles look like. They do look very much like tanks, right? And they're tread vehicles, so their impact is large as they make their way across the very fragile tundra landscapes. And we've got people out here both looking for these people to try to catch them. This is a fish, this is part of the fish patrol, right, out here looking for them, but they're making the exact same kinds of tracks that poachers are making across this landscape. So that's, I think, with the socioeconomic context, really something important to keep in mind. But of course, what you really want to know about is climate change, right, as promised in the beginning, in the title of the talk. So this second kind of biophysical change is directly related. So we can see, we have scientific as well as anecdotal and traditional knowledge of resources and territories that indicate that warming is indeed occurring. So glaciological data, a 400-year time series of tree ring data, and herding and subsistence gathering information all inform us about overall warming trends across this region. For example, we have a graph here from Diorgorov and Meyer writing in 2000. So yes, this is a little bit dated, but and I'll come back to thinking about the role of science and what kind of science is happening where in Russia and what kind of information is coming out in a minute. But we can think here, so this heavy black line are the Kamchatka glaciers. Right? So what we're really seeing, along with all of the others around different parts of the northern hemisphere, is a decline, right, over time in the volume of glaciers that exist. So this is just one of the pieces of evidence that point to the fact that climate is indeed changing.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Jessica Graybill is professor of geography at Colgate University, and she studies climate change discourse in Russia. She spoke recently about her research at the University of Utah. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today we're airing a talk given last week by Jessica Graybill. She's an associate professor of geography and the director of the Russian and Eurasian Studies program at Colgate University. She was in Utah last week, and she gave a presentation titled, "It's All Changing, But Not All Global Climate Change, Climate Discourses in Russia." Much of her research, she says, has involved simply talking with regular Russian citizens living in areas where environmental conditions have been noticeably changing in recent decades.
So given all of that change, socioeconomic, there's some cultural change going on here that I haven't talked a whole lot about today, biophysical change, how do you go in and research climate change from a social scientific perspective? How do you do this? How do you get out there and get people to talk to this about you? So this seething matrix, right, of socioeconomic and biophysical change, creates the local reality in these regions. So the major questions I find myself confronted with is to ask, how is climate change perceived then in local people's eyes, especially against this backdrop of other changes that are equally, if not more important in getting through everyday life struggles? So there's no one answer to this, right? And there's some people out there doing this different ways, but the way I go about looking about this, doing this, is thinking with a couple different kinds of methods. So I really like to go use ethnography, living and being in place as long as I can, which is not easy on an academic schedule, right? But going out there and living with people to learn what they're doing and what they're talking about every day. So it's not like an interview. I don't just go in and say, so what do you think about climate change, right? But being there and just hearing them talk about it. I use statistical data, or things like the data from the glacier that we talked about just a minute ago, with the volume decreasing. And another tool I've used in geography quite a bit is cognitive mapping. And so I'm happy to share with you some of my manuscripts on this topic if you're interested after the lecture. Okay, so research findings. So again, some of this is about resources and resource use. Some of this and subsistence use, and some of this is about climate change. But to me, they're inseparable in terms of trying to understand what's going on here, in terms of how people think. So my research into my results indicate some interesting things about perceptions of the environment, use of the environment, and concern or even lack thereof about the environment. First, participants in the study that I did in Kamchatka are quite interested in talking about the changing ideas of resources and resource bases on Kamchatka. In fact, they thrive on talking about this, especially about how environmental conditions have gotten worse and how they must go farther away into less hospitable resource places to reap lower quality harvests of fish, other marine resources, or hunted animals. But in their understanding, these are solvable problems, either through technological advancement, such as the use of snowmobiles to move further across the landscape, by resource replacement, so eating another fish instead of salmon, for example, or by stricter environmental enforcement. No one's holding their breath on that one. So in other words, even in the face of a changed resource base that is potentially worse than before, local and because of climate changes and other changes, local and indigenous peoples largely express that we will be resilient and overcome these problems. Okay? Either in personal actions, by technological improvement, or if the government suddenly becomes proactive in resource conservation. And that would be a new thing in the Russian case. Okay? So they know it's degraded. They all talk about it. They blame industry. They blame brakonierstvo is the over harvest of fish, right? So it's from the French word of brakonier. But these are all problems we can solve if we just figure it out among us humans. Okay, so raising the idea as a question that these environmental problems may be related to anthropogenic climate change, in Russian often called global climate change, which is why that phrase is up here, there was near total resistance to this idea. The gates went down, and people usually had one of three reactions here. Surprise that I would even bring this up. Anger. Anger that I would bring it up. Or disbelief. Right? Just doesn't exist. Okay, and then so often, after a lot of these conversations, it'll become clearer in the next slides that I show you, there's this idea of resisting this notion of anthropogenic climate change, either through anger or surprise or disbelief, or just not believing in it. And there's a lot of misunderstandings of what it means as well. So some of those understandings or misunderstandings are these. Global climate change is, in quotes, all of these phrases, all about money. It's a topic of belief, not knowledge. We can't know it's happening. It's a theory. You have to believe in it if you're really going to think this way, right? Or caused by natural climate cycles, not by human actions. And finally, solvable with technological innovation. And according to a prominent ecologist in Kamchatka, something that indigenous people will hang noodles on your ears about. It's a good Russian phrase. Hang noodles on your ears about, because they don't have the right kind of knowledge or understanding of the environment. And so what that means in Russian is to tell tall tale. Right? To hang noodles on someone's ears means to tell a tall tale. So I love that phrase. I had to throw that in here. Okay, so global climate change is all of these things. And that's not necessarily only in Kamchatka. So I'm going to take you through a little whirlwind tour of some of the things I've heard in different places, those six different dots I showed you at the beginning, and then come back to trying to make a little bit more sense of this. So in Kamchatka, climate change is a natural phenomenon. Climate has changed over the short-term history, over deeper, longer history. It's always a changing thing, and it's always natural. Humans are too small of a force on this planet to be able to cause what you're talking about. This is nuts, right? Add to that Sakhalin Island. Climate change is a political tool imagined by the West. Okay, this is something you outside Russia have dreamed up to make us have to change again, to think about something else that might be a problem in our lives. And in Vladivostok, climate change won't affect us. I heard this from numerous ecologists in the region. It's going to affect the U.S. and the Arctic. We are immune because of our geographic location, the fact that we have these islands protecting us on the other side. We're immune to sea level rise. It's not going to affect us. But you Americans, yes, it's going to affect you. And of course, it's happening in the Arctic. So Murmansk Oblast, where I was just there a couple weeks ago, One person. So that was all. Those three ones that I just showed you are things that were really part of very in-depth research. And the ones I'm going to show you now are sort of conversations, informal conversations I've had across different places. So I wouldn't call this research, so I certainly want to note that right now. But just things that I've heard in conversation with lots of different people. So a gentleman got very upset with a team of us out here who just we very casually asked what he thought about changing climate in the Arctic, which is the fastest region of change right now that we have due to climate change on the planet. And he said, well, I am no expert. I'm no expert in climate. I'm the chief of fire right here. It's only for experts to say if the climate is changing. I can tell you the weather's a little different, but I can't tell you about climate. Okay. And in Moscow, from scientists unofficially that I talk to quite often about these topics and others, including resource harvest, of course we know climate is changing, but we just can't officially say it. And I've heard this up to about 2012 or 13. And then in Saratov Oblast, which is a little bit more in the middle of the country, in the middle of the European part of Russia, let it change. Let the climate change. Of course it's changing. Let it change so we can reap the resource benefits. So one of the dialogues possibly about what climate change might bring to Russia is a longer growing season, right? A longer growing season with warmer weather. We should totally take advantage of this in our regions where we can actually grow things. And for the Arctic, let it all melt. Then we can get ships around this whole region and redevelop the whole area. So this discourse is not exclusive to Saratov Oblast alone, but I just put it here rather than other places to be able to show you the amalgamation of the very mixed messages in many ways that are going on across this vast continent, Eurasian continent, for thinking about it. So again, over here in the east, in the Far East, this is all based on formal research. Right? And these are based on informal conversations in more European Russia. I just really want to be clear about that. I find it really interesting. There's a lot of mixed messages here. There's a lot of hope, possibly, for the future. Right? Let it change so we can reap the resource benefits. There's a little bit of denial going on as to what's actually changing. There's a little bit of intrigue, political intrigue going on in multiple places. Right? And there's a real reliance on thinking about who experts are and the importance of the words of experts. Okay, so I'm a geographer, I can't not show you a map for thinking about this. So let's just do a quick reality check on physical locations and what we know about sea level rise already occurring and will continue to occur into the future. Okay, so Kamchatka, Sakhalin, and Vladivostok. I just turned the frame a little bit here. So those same things I was talking about north and south are now oriented a little bit differently. Here's Vladivostok, here's Sakhalin Island, and here's Kamchatka Peninsula. Well, they're all located next to major ocean basins, right, if you will. So here's the Pacific, and here is the Sea of Okhotsk, and the China Sea over here. So we've got some places where sea levels will rise. That's just a fact. It's going to happen, right? There's projections for that into the not-too-distant future. We can say the very same thing about the Russian Arctic. So up here in Murmansk and Teriberka, where I was just recently, this is the Kola Peninsula. Finland is right over here. The same phenomenon, sea level rise, will affect coastal communities here as well. And in the Russian heartland, the broadly forested areas, think about those peat fires that I showed on the very first slide in Moscow, right? The broadly forested areas with rivers and the steppe region. It's a little bit hard to see, but here's the Aral Sea here. And if we talk about really arid regions, we have a little bit less arid, but also still pretty dry. Think Kansas, Oklahoma, right, in terms of an analog. Pretty dry areas where peat is something that forms underground. And the fact that it got set on fire is amazing. Right, due to to temperatures that Moscow hasn't seen in a very long time. Over here in Saratov, they will experience drought in the same areas where they'd like to grow more things in the future because climate change is going to bring them better temperature regimes. We also have a water problem if we're talking about arid landscapes. Of course, here in Utah, you know all about that too.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on this program, we are airing a talk given last week by Jessica Graybill. She is the director of the Russia and Eurasian Studies Program at Colgate University, and she spoke about her research into climate change discourses across Russia. Graybill researches urban and socio-environmental transformations on communities and in areas engaged in resource extraction in Russia. And her research also involves why people either choose to act or not to act when faced with environmental changes or the overwhelming data and science of climate change.
Okay, so why is there resistance? Why is there resistance to accepting climate change as a reality? Well, all of these things are part of it. Often, response to change is analyzed in relation to why people don't act in the face of change, or why something like, say, the precautionary principle, a good sort of foundational environmental studies thing, is not adhered to. So even though people know that certain species are at risk from human actions, like overharvest of salmon locally, there's no application of protective measures to ensure the future of that ecosystem for both human and non-human communities. And that's a scary prospect, right, writ large. So resistance to the very idea of more large-scale change that may change everything, as Naomi Klein warns us in her book's title, this changes everything, right, is creating a roadblock for visualizing and acting to prevent ecosystems disaster from perhaps the greatest change, the most devastating perestroika that people in Russia will historically experience. Some of that has to do with the role of science as suspect in the 19th century, or turning that somewhat on its head, the role of humans in control of nature through the Soviet period. It also very much has to do with the fact that oil and gas is the mode of national development across Russia right now, and much of the former Soviet Union as well. And there's too much at stake to change this course right now in the 21st century. With all of that as a backdrop, there's also been decreased scientific training of Russian scientists since the 1990s. That's starting to turn around now. People are starting to go back to do PhDs. But business and law were the degrees that Russians got in the 1990s and in the 00s, right? So there was no one going out and doing this science, except the random occasional foreigner coming in to ask these questions. Starting to change now, certainly. There's often too little political will to change, okay? And we could also think of just about the role of change alone. Too many changes for too long in the too recent past. And so 1917 doesn't seem too recent to many of us in the room, but really in terms of national systems, this is not that long of a time slice, 100 years. My gosh, it's 100 years, right? It's really not that long in terms of the kinds of change that Russia and its peoples, indigenous, Siberians, locals, Muscovites, Petersburgers, whoever they are, it's not that long in terms of thinking everything they've gone through. So I think one of the things I definitely want to say here is that, well, Russia's not alone, right? We shouldn't paint this picture as just Russia not addressing these things. And it's increasingly important to recognize that the powerful and geographically widespread counter-narratives to the dominant consensus, near consensus global science discourse that climate change is real, this has to be acknowledged. While the global science community is busy scrambling to understand physical change to ecosystems in what many are now calling the Anthropocene, there are other changes in histories and stakeholders that sometimes seem more crucial in day-to-day life decision-making than this grand narrative would lead us to believe. So Russia's not alone. And there's other really good studies of skepticism, climate skepticism and denial out there. And I put up book titles rather than pictures of articles, because it's just easier to look at a book than think about the myriad of articles out there as well. There's Norgard's study of Norway, Living in Denial, tells us that Norwegians, right in the north, in a very well-developed country, they say, yeah, sure, we know climate's changing. Yes, it's anthropogenic, it's human-made, we know it. But we're just not going to change how we live, because we like it. Right? So that's, I don't know if you call that climate denial or skepticism or just apathy. Right? Maybe climate apathy is a better way to think about that. Then we have a book by Will Storr, thinking about the unpersuadables, people who just simply will not be persuaded that science has any answers that help society or the environment, right? And we also have a really wonderful book. If you're going to pick up any of these books, I would pick up this one by Mike Holm, his UK-based scientist, who talks about how real the physical evidence for climate change is. And then he goes on to talk about why we disagree about what's going on. And he points to thinking about a society, economics, religion, the role of all of those things in our everyday lives. So Russia's not alone, right? And there's a lot of scholars working on this in other places. Okay, so that leads me to think about maybe a little bit of a climate decision tree. And so I'm just going to leave a little the question over here. Do you agree that climate is changing due to human actions on Earth? And there's sort of, this is a 1-2 answer. It's a binary, right? Yes or no. If we as a, and so it kind of goes like this. If you say, well, no, then there's no further action required, and it's business as usual. You can just keep living your life as you want. But if you say yes, notice I've put this in red and green for thinking about this. If you say yes, well, that requires a lot of things to happen at once. It requires you to act. You. Not necessarily your government or a big corporation, but you. It requires you to act on this immediately. It requires more scientific studies and monitoring of the landscape, of the terrestrial reservoir for carbon, of the atmospheric reservoir for carbon, all sorts of things. And it requires new rules and regulation that impose environmental pollution limits. And I think we're seeing that struggle in our own country right now for part of this. So the climate decision tree is simple, right? This is really simple. It's yes or no. But there's a lot involved in answering either way. But if we as a global community hope to create just policy decisions about climate change that are based on real scientific studies about and for local people and places, we have to not only acknowledge but engage with narratives about all transformations that may be occurring in order to understand the communities about whom we're talking and who will be most affected in the short and long-term futures. Sometimes that's about engaging other science traditions, such as traditions of understanding climate as naturally produced, climate change as naturally produced in Russia. And sometimes it's simply about engaging people in conversation, any conversation, scientific, informal, over tea, whatever it is. After all, when I think about this and the things I've heard in Russia about climate change, I do have to remember, I don't live in the places I'm talking about. I only live in my hometown. My local challenges are going to be very different than those faced by the Russians that I've talked to. And my adaptations will be different than theirs, as the climate does actually continue to change underfoot. Engagement among all of us and for the long term is the key. And this requires humanistic approaches to the strength, which are the strengths of social scientists and humanists. That's absolutely key. Some people would argue we know enough about what's actually changing out there. You can always learn more things about the biophysical changes. But many people would say we need our humanists and our social scientists to step up to really figure out how we're actually going to grapple, even with something as seemingly simple as this climate decision tree. Okay. So returning to Russia, right, so of course we've gone narrow into Kamchatka, broad to across Russia, other places besides Russia, and I'd like to return on this last little bit here, last slide really, to talk about the role of change. And change as really an unwanted way of life, and thinking about that that's been an unwanted way of life for far too long, question mark. So if we can think about just the last 100 years since 1917, we can talk about the introduction and building of communism, the tearing apart, and I'm going right back to Kamchatka for this, okay? Tearing apart of indigenous families for civilizing and schooling in Soviet boarding schools, internats, collectivization and resettlement, rule by fear, Stalin era, World War II, the Great War, right, in Russia. The period of the thaw in the 1960s, followed by glasnost and perestroika. 1991, the collapse. 25 years now of transformation. Dealing, in other words, with everyday persistent poverty for many people and figuring out how to just get through it. So with that context, it's really easy to understand why resistance on the ground to even mentioning livelihood-threatening changes in this subarctic Russian far north and east stems from a place of self-protection. It's a discourse of resilience. We're resilient. We have survived all of the changes thrown at us by the 20th century, and we don't want any more in the 21st. We just simply don't want it. I'm not going to listen anymore. I can't. Because that resilience, that resistance has served local peoples well at the very local levels. It has bonded communities socially and territorially as people relearn to depend on each other to cope with this near systemic collapse time after time throughout the last 100 years. So change in this region, that's about Kamchatka, but you could also say it's about a lot of Russia, is constant and nothing is stationary. So this has to be acknowledged. This social science and humanistic understanding of what people are going through must be acknowledged in the work of climate change if we're to have a record of the human and social science, human and social sides of what's going on in our Anthropocene. So often dominated by physical world knowledge and characteristics, we must work to ensure that humans are written into this history as both agents and receptors of change. Without this, I ask you, for whom are we saving the environment? Why should we even try? Why do we talk about climate change if we're not going to take into account how it's affecting the very people that are on this planet for the short and long term? Okay. Thank you very much. And I'll take any questions. Okay, let's see. Questions on the mic. Yeah, I understand.
If anybody has a question, you're welcome to ask it. Just wait until the mic gets to you so you can be on the radio.
Exciting.
Jessica, you mentioned that lack of political will was a factor. I wonder if you could expand on the political dimension a little bit. I mean, on the one hand, you see President Putin go out to Siberia and take off his shirt, and he's helping some sort of Siberian tiger cubs, or he's trying to help cranes fly where they're supposed to go.
Yes.
But on the other hand, he has several times at least insinuated that environmental concerns about pipelines he wanted to build or that sort of thing, there's basically foreign plots to hold back Russia's economic development.
Right.
And also the labeling of any NGOs in Russia who receive foreign assistance,
agents.
Or if environmental, any other kind of labeling as foreign agents,
yep.
Must be a problem.
Yeah. Thank you for raising that. I think that the political aspects are large, right, for dealing with this, and there's been a lot written on this. Ilana Wilson-Rowe was someone who writes about this a lot, as well as Paula Tinkinen. And these are European scientists, right, Finnish, Norwegian scientists right on the border, really concerned about what's going on here. So if you remember the picture of the burning peat forests outside of Moscow from the title slide, and that was 2010. Up until that time, there was sort of a lip service to climate change in Russia. Oh, sure, yeah. Maybe it's changing. But not really a real engagement with what that meant in country. And 2010, Putin received quite a bit of criticism over the fact that these peat fires had begun due to what's thought as extreme temperatures in the region, but also due to forest mismanagement. So there's a lot going on in all of these stories that it's really hard to pull apart different threads all the time. Some people would just say it's weather and not climate. Others would argue and say it's all about climate change. You know, it's endless in terms of these things. Now, one of the things that I've written about and others have written about as well is thinking about the role of Russia in something like the Kyoto Protocol, where they seem to be very active in accepting of the fact that climate change is happening and we must address it, versus in country. And what they're doing is very, very little. And I've written about that and spoken about that in other places. Didn't bring that so much into here because I really wanted to focus on people and what they're saying here. But I would say that there's two different dialogues going on. There's one that's external, Russia's external face to the world, and there's one that's internal in terms of addressing it, by and large, to the external world and saying we're on it, and to the internal world really saying, just go right ahead with the pipeline, right, for example. So I know that's a very short answer to a really big topic, but I think there's two dialogues going on in that sense, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. particularly now with current relations.
Hi, thank you very much for this. It was very interesting. I've read some about indigenous populations in Canada and other Arctic areas, and it seems to me that their reactions, some of them anyway, are very different than the indigenous ones you described here, that they are not feeling resilient and they're feeling a lot of loss. But maybe perhaps part of the difference is their tribes are more cohesive, and they have tribal lands, and they have very much subsistence knowledge and subsistence practices. So could you talk a little bit more about the indigenous there? And part of what you mentioned, maybe the annihilation, or do they still have cohesive tribal identity, governments? Right. Is that part of the change you're seeing?
Yeah, thank you. That's another really good question. So I would also want to be very clear that I spoke with indigenous people as well as post-Soviet people, right, who had identified very differently than indigenous but are in these locations. So that's first and foremost, this is mixed that way, not purely about indigenous peoples. The other thing I'll say is that there are over 300 different native peoples groups in Russia today. Many of them are quite small. Many of them have been decimated over time, and many of them have left their homelands for other places or live in the big city, right? So I brought in that city of Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky in the Kamchatka case as well. So the kinds of communities you're getting, if you go out, say, to rural Kamchatka, where I was, are very small, not well-educated communities that are trying to get some kind of revival of culture going. And that means everything, right, from understanding how to subsistence hunt or fish well, how to not harm the landscape, how to dance the traditional dances, etc. All those different components are coming together. But all of that is coming in a background of very reduced scientific knowledge of what's going on as well. Versus the Canadian case, and of course there are multiple different groups in Canada as well, but where science is really accessible. And there are a lot of people from southern parts of Canada going up into northern communities to teach them about the changes. That's one thing that's going on. I think that in a lot of Russia, and I heard this from people on Kamchatka who don't know what's happening on Sakhalin, which is 200 miles away, right? They don't know what's happening in each other's communities, and that was part of the Soviet strategy, to isolate each group, right? So that nobody knew what everybody else was experiencing, because that way you can keep the masses under control. And I don't think that's what's happening today in the same way. Certainly, that level of control is not there, but it exists, and it still exists in the sense that, for example, if I wanted to go from Kamchatka to Sakhalin, I would be best off going through Moscow on a plane. It's more expensive to fly between those two places than it is to go all the way, 9-hour flight to Moscow and 9 hours back. So while I don't think that's intentional, those controls still exist so that people don't have the chance to meet each other and talk about these things. That's changing a little bit around the Sea of Okhotsk. I hate it when professors do this, but I'm going to do it. If we go all the way back up here to think about this map of the Sea of Okhotsk region, there's been a lot of resistance to the oil and gas projects here about 10 years ago. By local and indigenous peoples alike, and foreign NGOs, those agents of terror, right? And they started to work with people on Kamchatka as soon as the oil and gas shelf opened up on that other side. So that kind of communication is happening, but it's because of the role of NGOs today. It's not because people know on each place what's happening in different places. So we have a really different dissemination of knowledge, both scientific as well as just what's happening in everyday life, than we do in Canada or Alaska.
Are you able to tell me just a little bit about how Russia's political system works, or like how it's supposed to work versus how it's currently working? Because I don't really know about that at all.
What do you want to know? Because that's like a yes.
Yeah,
what interests you particularly?
Like, what would it take for, like, regulations to be passed?
Okay.
Like, who has that power?
Okay, so environmental, so I'm going to stick with environmental regulations here for thinking about that. Yeah, this is a big question, right? Because you're probably thinking, and shout out if I'm wrong, but this sounds terrible. Why aren't there some environmental regulations out there that control the, you know, this over-harvest and all these things? And good Lord, like, what's going on? So the answer to that is not a pretty story, right? The Soviet era did not have great environmental regulations. In the post-Soviet era, and I'll use the Sakhalin case as a place to start with this, because it's where I know about environmental regulations the most. When the oil and gas company, the transnational oil and gas companies came in, every regulation that Europe had, every regulation that the US had was put on the books to become Russian regulation. We're going to take it all and we're going to do everything, and it's going to be the most regulated oil and gas development site ever. Well, there's another really good Russian phrase. In principle, yes, they are all on the books. But in practice, very few of those actually get enacted. And so, right, there's a fish mafia on Kamchatka. Right, the fish, it's a big deal. It's the biggest part of the economy there. So things, you know, things are, there's a blind eye that gets turned. And a lot of the decisions get made out of Moscow. And I've told you already, it's a 9-hour flight from these regions to Moscow. So getting people from Moscow out here to look at what's going on or vice versa is huge. So coming back to the question about Putin going out and helping the cranes fly, I mean, these are stunts. Right? These are stunts to show that leadership cares about the region. Right? Multiple cranes died in that experiment, by the way, but we won't go there right now.
Yeah, so I just have a quick question. I appreciate this presentation and your personal experience in these areas. Going back to the political will and asking for regulations, if in practice it seems that people are looking away, has there been any history of incentives being successful, getting people to try and do things because it's going to benefit their business rather than them looking at it as something that is cumbersome?
Thank you. That's another great question. That is, how shall I say, in a very nascent stage. That may be the case in Moscow or St. Petersburg, where the populations are much, much larger than we're talking out in the Far East particularly. It's the lowest populated area of Russia out where I'm talking. But right now, I think we could say that this is still in the phase of dikiy kapitalizm, so wild capitalism, which is a phrase that got used a lot in the 1990s to describe business growth and how it occurred across Russia. But the Far East is probably one of the last outposts for businessmen who kind of, if they have enough capital to start with, can really get moving on something they want to do. Let me give you an example from Kamchatka really briefly. When I was there in 2009-10 on a fellowship, there's geothermal energy here, right? There's geothermal energy that could be tapped to provide, in greenhouses, fruits and vegetables. It could be tapped to provide heating in all the apartment buildings throughout this region. Great potential, just like Iceland, right? And when approached, you know, when talking about this idea with different peoples, they said, oh, no, no, that will never happen here because oil and gas are more important to the powers that be. So the political elite are entrenched in an oil and gas network, right, to gasify the island, to make sure that the oil and gas gets developed off these shelf areas in the offshore region. And it went to the extent that one, you know, we don't know who, because you never know exactly who, but they poured concrete, right, like raw concrete, down a geyser to make it stop, so that geothermal energy could not be developed in the region. A small geyser, not a big one, right? And not in a protected natural park area. But it's to that level of corruption and also lack of will to change the current power structure that we're talking about in these kinds of regions.
Jessica Graybill is director of the Russia and Eurasian Studies program at Colgate University. She spoke about her research of climate change discourse in Russia last week at the University of Utah. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.